Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. As you go about your day, you will be exposed to an estimated 3,000 advertisements. So what happens when advertising never stops? That's the question today's guest, Mark Bartholomew, asks in his new book, Ad Creep, The Case Against Modern Marketing. He reveals how modern advertising is encroaching our personal lives like never before. He writes, "This is Ad Creep, Modern Marketing's March to Create a World Where Advertising Can Be Expected Anywhere and at Any Time. Whether we realize it or not, ad creep has come, transforming not just our purchasing decisions, but our relationships, our sense of self, and the way we navigate all spaces, public and private. So what are the consequences of living in a world with nonstop advertising, and what can we do about it? Mark Bartholomew is professor at the University at Buffalo School of Law. He's provided commentary on intellectual property, privacy, and advertising issues in the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Wall Street Journal. He's the author of the new book, Ad Creep, The Case Against Modern Marketing. And Mark Bartholomew joins us from the studios of WNED in New York. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks a lot.
Well, it's great to have you. You start off your book by talking about the Minority Report, the Steven Spielberg science fiction film that was released back in 1999. And you point out that it predicted our future, where advertising tools would be used to collect our personal information, things like biometric scans, automated online spies, and facial recognition software. Well, just this week, Apple came out with their new phone that does have facial recognition software. Did you think that companies would be using these technologies in the year 2017?
I mean, I didn't, you know, years ago. And you know, I would say 10 years ago, I wasn't someone who was aware of all the advertising around me and the technologies that are being leveraged just to find out more about me as a consumer. But once I started kind of researching this, I realized that, you know, there's not an isolated story here or there. This is a calculated effort where we are just kind of giving advertisers more and more information because of these technological changes.
And this is something that we have been talking about for decades, but technology has really changed the game. Can you talk about how technology has created this world where advertising never stops?
Yeah, so there's a few things. I think one thing that the technology does now that just takes us into a different kind of era as far as our relationship with marketers is there's this constant collection of data on us. And before, there were lots of moments where you'd, even if you made a commercial transaction, that wasn't the site of a lot of disclosure of things about yourself. You'd pay with cash at the store, you'd take your product home, that was it. But, you know, more and more now, even in the moments when we're not doing anything commercial and we're simply posting things online or reading things online or even starting a post and not even sending it, all that becomes fodder for an enormous digital dossier on us, which is used to send advertisements to us that will appeal to us as individuals. And also we're learning more and more that advertisers have the ability to seek us out in real time. And that's an important distinction between the past. This technology lets us be located in physical space, but also lets us more and more be pinpointed how we're feeling, how we differ from the people next to us. And that's a big difference, right? If you can appeal to someone at a particular level, at a particular emotional state, as a particular individual, you have a much better chance of closing the sale than you would if you're just appealing to kind of the people at a sort of a mass level.
You also point out that even when ads become part of the scenery and are processed at a low level of attention, they still have an influence. The expansion of advertising and normalization of its messages makes it easier for advertisers to get past our defenses and convince us to purchase. Now, I think this is really interesting because a lot of us think, and I think this, that I've trained my brain not to see ads. So I can't really even tell you the last ad that I heard or that I've seen. But you make a point that these ads are still entering our subconscious.
Yeah, I think, you know, one thing that the psychological literature tells us is that even when we see ads, you know, just in the periphery of our vision, and like you, we feel like we've kind of trained ourselves to ignore them, they still have an effect. And psychologists talk about these things called somatic markers, where a memory can be planted and then that memory can be retrieved later on. So, you know, advertisers, we know, maybe we see the same ad 30, 40, 50 times and we think, well, I've trained myself to ignore it. But actually, that familiarity is all part of a plan to kind of seed our brain with an attitude, a response to the ad, and then later that can be brought to the surface later. And you know, I know people are skeptical of this, and I don't mean to imply that advertisers can just, you know, invade our subconscious and do what they will with us. But there are studies, like one showing that if someone is primed with a prestige brand, you know, think Rolls-Royce or Neiman Marcus or something like that, then they will behave differently. They won't realize they've been primed by this and it won't enter their mind, but they'll behave differently and they'll make a choice to go for a prestige item, not really the Neiman Marcus or Rolls-Royce, but some other prestige item as opposed to maybe the more utilitarian, you know, brand, you know. So they'll go for the Louis Vuitton instead of the Target purchase if they're given that option. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think this shows that has an effect. You know, Apple is another good example. You brought up Apple. Mm-hmm. Just being primed with the Apple logo causes people to take more chances, to behave, you know, in a more creative fashion, even if they haven't realized that they've seen that brand.
You have an entire chapter on neuromarketing, and it's a process by which advertisers use new insights into the functioning of the brain to redesign the ads we watch, the marketplaces we frequent, and the products we buy. Tell us about neuromarketing. Who came up with this concept?
Yeah, so this is something that, you know, has always been on market researchers' minds. You know, how can we appeal to people in a way that reads kind of their unfiltered neural responses? Because the problem with market research is that sometimes people in focus groups or in surveys will tell advertisers what they want to hear. You know, think of the introduction of New Coke in the 80s. Coke did a bunch of focus groups. They thought they knew what people wanted, but it turned out that their responses were somewhat misleading, and we had, you know, maybe the biggest flop in the history of advertising. But the thought is, well, if we can reach in and find this holy grail where we scan people's brains without them realizing it, or at least without them being able to filter their responses, then we'll have a much better sense of what people really want. And so there's been efforts to do this, but again, this is where technology enters the story. Now, thanks to greater processing speeds and new technology, we can use functional magnetic resonance imaging and other technologies to get an unfiltered view of people's responses to advertisements. And this can be potentially very, very valuable to advertisers. You know, if I can just tell one story about this being applied.
Yes, please.
The folks who make Cheetos, right? They did scans of a bunch of a test group of consumers, and they showed them different images of people with Cheetos and different advertising campaigns they were thinking about. And what they noticed is when people saw images of the cheesy dust on your fingers from eating Cheetos, what many people would say if they were asked directly, you know, how they feel about that is, oh, that's a liability. I love the taste of Cheetos, but I don't like that stuff that gets on my fingers. But when these folks looked at the scans of people's brains, it suggested that when people saw the images of the dust on the fingers, their brains lit up with this sense of pleasure. Right. And so the marketers took this information and actually used it in a campaign to emphasize kind of the sense of subversion, the sense of kind of rebelling against authority from eating Cheetos. And, you know, who knows if this ad campaign actually led to this, but sales were goosed by nearly $50 million after that campaign ran.
Wow. You also write in your book about how brain scans showed Procter & Gamble how to address women's anxiety over our bad hair days in shampoo ads. Campbell's examined data on pupil dilation, heart rate, sweat levels, and changes in body posture to develop soup can labels with a more emotional impact. How did they go about doing that?
Well, you know, one thing is that businesses aren't always that willing to disclose, these campaigns because of the creep factor, right? Mm-hmm. They don't necessarily want to tell us all the details about how this market research has worked. So some of this is kind of piecing together reports about these studies without getting into all the details. But the basic process is one where you take a group of consumers, and from what I've read, you can do this with a relatively small amount of people, 25 people, scan their brains in response to the advertising stimuli, and then you just simply kind of test different kinds of advertisements. What's the brain response to this? What's the brain response to that? And from that, you can get a better sense of what's going to captivate consumers. And the other thing that's important here is that this all dovetails with our increasing understanding of the brain and how its different parts work and work together. Mm-hmm. So, before, I think there was a reason to be very, very skeptical about this kind of technology. You'd say, oh, well, just one part of the brain, lit up. That's the buy button of the brain. You'd see some early press reports talking about the buy button of the brain. And we know now that this is a very complex process with a bunch of parts of the brain working together. But what advertisers have now, what neuroscientists have now, is the capacity to record very small fluctuations in very short amounts of time in different areas of the brain and get a better sense of what people are actually experiencing and what they're feeling when they see different stimuli, including marketing stimuli.
You write that neuromarketing is being used by a number of multinationals, including Citibank, Google, Hewlett-Packard, McDonald's, Microsoft, and ESPN. So a lot of companies are embracing this technology.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that right there is a reason to take it very seriously. So we have lots of companies using this technology. We have lots of folks on neuroscience, scientists and people on university faculties entering partnerships and forming companies where they do this kind of market research. And so this is something that advertisers aren't just dipping a toe in the water, they're embracing.
Today, we are speaking with Mark Bartholomew about his new book, Ad Creep, The Case Against Modern Marketing. And according to many estimates, we are exposed to over 3,000 ads a day. So what happens when advertising never stops? That's one of the many questions that Mark asks in his new book. And if you'd like to join us, we'd love to hear from you. 3,000 ads a day. At first, it seems like that's not possible. But if you listen to the radio, you watch some television, thumbs through some, maybe a magazine at the dentist office, and then you think about what you do online, you realize that is very possible, that we could be exposed to 3,000 ads a day. So what are your thoughts about that? And what do you think, or what questions do you have about how advertising has really changed over the years, especially now that we all really embrace technology and give tech companies so much of our personal information? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Mark, speaking of embracing technology without asking many questions, many of us have phones, like iPhones or Google phones, and a lot of us use phone apps. And sometimes we have to click, I agree to the terms of service, but who really reads that? The font is also usually too small to read. And this one really caught my attention in your book. You write that supposedly free apps for smartphones pull sensitive information off user phones and then provide that information to third parties. Your favorite phone app might send copies of your contact lists, text messages, internet search history, physical location, and even your phone photos to market research firms. How is this possible? How are they allowed to do this?
Well, it's just what you said in large part. We click I agree in those mountains of legal boilerplate that everybody knows is there, but they don't read and they couldn't understand if they did read, and that gives away our rights often in cases to say, well, hold on, I want to give my sensitive information to the makers of this app, but I'm not willing to give it to third parties. So, we kind of rely on this legal fiction that the consumer knows what they're getting into, that they're aware of the costs and the benefits of this when they install the app. But we're not. And I think part of the problem here is that this goes on kind of behind the scenes. This data we're constantly kind of emitting is passed between the shadowy companies, these data brokers, and sold in real-time auctions to send advertisements to us later on and to know us on a more personal level. And we can't see it. We can't see it going on. And so, you know, we kind of keep doing it. And it's very forgivable for the consumer because they can't see what's happening and they can't understand the legal language that's, you know, that's granting the rights to these third party companies. But, you know, it's happening all the time.
You write that by installing the Bing search engine smartphone app, a user agrees to allow Microsoft to record audio, send emails to guests, and read the data on the phone, all without the user's knowledge. So there's so many apps out there. A lot of us use them. What are these companies doing with our text messages, our contact lists, the photos we take on our phones?
Yeah, so they're mining that for information. So I read recently about how you can think big companies, think Under Armour, think Nike, think McDonald's, are reviewing posts, reviewing photos, and using software to look and see photos where their product is in the same space as someone's face, and then interpreting the emotion on that face. Are you smiling when you're next to that product? If so, you're probably receptive to their brand. Or if you're smiling next to a rival, is there some way they can use that information to leverage a competing offer? So you'll move away from Nike to Under Armour. So that's one example of you know, just the photos we disclose online and think they're just going to our friends, they're actually becoming fodder for market research. Also, you know, what's really important is location. So a lot of these apps, you're encouraged, you know, when you go into a physical retailer to install the app, and you might get discounts for this. You might just be able to take advantage of their Wi-Fi. But one of the reasons they want you to install that app is because they can track your location. Mm-hmm. They can track your location in the store, and sometimes the terms of these apps let them track your location, you know, outside of the store, even outside of that physical boundary. And location is of tremendous value as a data point for advertisers.
Right. So, for example, I was just looking at the apps that I have on my phone, mostly news apps, but a couple, there's like a veggie grill app. And so I'm thinking, if I'm in the area, they would be able to send me a coupon or come on in for a free drink.
Absolutely. And you can see how that'd be of tremendous value. You know, if you're reaching someone right where they're in the area, and perhaps you can combine that with a bunch of other data saying, oh, you know what? We know from her posts that, you know, Rose tends to get hungry for pizza around 4:30 p.m. or Mark is, you know, usually trying to fill up the gas in his car on Wednesdays at 7 p.m. Well, if you can send a message right at that kind of moment when we're most susceptible and are most interested in those kinds of appeals, you know, that's very valuable.
What can we do about this, specifically when we're talking about the information that companies grab based on how we use their apps and the text messages, the photos, our contact list? What can we do about that?
Yeah, I mean, I don't have a tremendously, you know, hopeful or useful, I think, recipe of things to do. So you can be a little bit more careful, and you can, you know, decline certain apps. I think, you know, those ones where kind of on-the-ground retailers want you to download the app when you go through their store, sure, you might get a discount, but I find those are often very invasive, or kind of the apps for hotel chains where, you know, you can use your phone to check into your room instead of going to the front desk. And, you know, that's valuable. It's nice to save the time at the front desk, but you're going to be paying with some privacy at that point. So you can decline to use those things. You can try to be a little more careful about, you know, where you run your searches, what you disclose online. But for me, you know, the problem here is a framework that we really can't opt out of most of the time. You know, we can't just say, well, I'm not going to use social media, or I'm not going to use a smartphone. And, you know, once we participate, you know, once we embrace this technology, it's really hard to avoid disclosing all this data about ourselves that's going to be used by advertisers.
Today, we're joined by Mark Bartholomew, author of Ad Creep, The Case Against Modern Marketing. Mark is professor at the University at Buffalo School of Law, and he writes about intellectual property, privacy, and advertising for The New York Times, The Washington Post, and other publications. And by many estimates out there, we are exposed to 3,000 ads every single day. So what happens when advertising never stops? Mark writes that in a world where advertising can be expected conducted anywhere and anytime is a world where our abilities to defend ourselves against these ads becomes far less effective. If you have any questions or comments for Mark, we'd love to hear from you. And what do you think? If you use your phone, which so many of us do, and free apps, someone was just telling me about a meditation app yesterday and how she loves using that. But what are your thoughts knowing that some of these apps collect your lists, your text messages, your photos, and as Mark says, there's really not much we can do about it because we agree to the terms of service. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Let's hear from Ruthann in El Cerrito. Hi, Ruthann. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. I was going to say I'm not immune to subliminal effects of advertising, but I'm doing my best. I do not own a cell phone. I do not own a smartphone. I don't do Facebook. I don't Twitter. What I wanted to ask the guest is, do his comments about advertising and everything that's being done apply similarly to the underwriting at, that's supposedly not advertising, but it really is, at public radio?
Okay. Great question. So, you know, I'd say there's a difference in kind here, because the underwriting is at least more transparent. So I think one thing, you know, so the book's called Ad Creep, and part of the reason I gave it that title is I wanted to interrogate what's creepy about it. You know, sometimes I tell people these stories about what advertisers are doing, and they say, oh, that's creepy, but they don't really think about it any further. And we have to think, well, why does it bother us? And so for me, at least, when the advertiser is undisclosed or what they're doing with your information is undisclosed, that's moving past persuasion, which I think we accept a certain amount of, you know, commercial entities are trying to persuade us, and more towards manipulation. We can't see what's going on behind the scenes, but it's being leveraged against us. The underwriting, you know, I think is different in that it's more transparent. We kind of know, okay, we know that someone's underwriting this NPR show, and we'll take that into account when we're hearing the story. So I would treat those somewhat differently in kind.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in, Ruthann. And wow, congrats that you don't have a cell phone or use Facebook or social media. You probably don't need that meditation app. Let's go next to Peter in San Francisco. Hi, Peter. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Good morning. I have a question, and that is, what? First of all, I don't know if you're aware of Tristan Harris, and the who has been doing a research on how tech companies are creating addiction. Modes of addiction through, you know, smartphones and cell phones, and how they're designed to keep you addicted to your phone. But my question is, what can one do? I mean, if you have to use Apple to, say, find a job or, you know, to help, you know, protect your health, and it says, you know, do you agree, yes or no? It's like saying, you know, do you agree on to have oxygen, or do you agree to, you know, not live in a house that's filled with fleas? I mean, of course you're going to say yes because you have no option. I mean, and regarding the caller that called before, I agree. I wish I didn't have to have a smartphone or anything like that. But, you know, there are no more payphones, and it seems to me that, like I said, you know, you have to click yes because it's the option is, you know, do you want oxygen or not? You know, do you want access to society or not?
Yeah, thank you, Peter.
So you mentioned Tristan Harris, and yeah, his work on this is great. And there's also a psychologist at NYU, Adam Alter, who's written on this and how these technologies are addictive, and they're purposely addictive. And you know, there's studies showing that just the presence of that smartphone in the room, you know, on the table while people are having a conversation, causes people to behave differently, less attuned to facial responses, less, you know, less able to remember what people have said, even if it's just, you know, on the table and people aren't even looking at it. So I guess one thing you could do, even though we're all forced to live in this world where we have to use smartphones, often we need to, you know, reach out to people on social media, is to at least set quarantine times. You know, so I try to put the smartphone away at a certain time at night and not pick it up again until, you know, after breakfast in the morning. And I try to really police that with my kids as well. You know, so that's one thing that we can at least try to do. But I'll say again, it's hard, and we're forced to participate in these spaces. And one thing that's very different is that, you know, often these spaces in the past were more kind of for communicating, or more civic, more public. And today, you know, we communicate through these private entities, these platforms like Facebook that aren't civic, aren't public. They're controlled by a business that's responsible to its stockholders. And what do they want to do? They want to manufacture the most attention they can, the most outrage, because that generates attention, the most titillation, because that generates attention. And those things aren't necessarily good for us.
Well, thank you for calling in, Peter. Today, we are speaking with Mark Bartholomew. His new book is called Ad Creep, The Case Against Modern Marketing. By some estimates, we are exposed to about 3,000 advertisements every day. And Mark writes that this is Ad Creep, Modern Marketing's March to Create a World Where Advertising Can Be Expected Anywhere and at Any Time. Whether we realize it or not, Ad Creep has come, transforming not just our purchasing decisions, but our relationships, our sense of self, and the way we navigate all spaces, public and private. So we've been talking a little bit about phone apps, and coming up after the break, we'll talk about facial recognition and then how this has really changed civic space, as Mark just said, specifically advertising on public lands, in public parks, and at public schools. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are joined by Mark Bartholomew. We're talking about his new book, Ad Creep, The Case Against Modern Marketing. Mark is professor at the University at Buffalo School of Law, and he writes about intellectual property, privacy, and advertising. He's been featured in the New York Times and the LA Times, among other publications. By some estimates, we're exposed to about 3,000 ads a day. And in Mark's new book, he writes about how technology has really transformed advertising, what happens in a world where advertising is anywhere. He also writes about phone apps, facial recognition software, ads in public parks and public schools. And if you have any questions or comments for Mark, if this is something you've been thinking about, how do you feel that advertising has really changed over the last couple of decades? And what are your thoughts about how technology has really changed this entire landscape? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. How do you, in your daily life, try to escape all of this? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. We were talking earlier about phone apps, Mark, and now I'd like you to tell us more about facial recognition technology. As I said, the new iPhone just came out, and it's relying on face recognition technology, and so many tech companies are embracing this. How do you expect this will enter our lives, whether we like it or not?
Yeah, so I think, like these other technologies, it'll be used to just gain more and more data about who we are and how we're feeling. So, you know, the iPhone announcement kind of just shows how more mainstream this technology is getting and how it's getting better and better. So, you know, these things are being used to pinpoint age and gender when people do things like pump gas in their cars, when they stroll through different stores. And I think what the Apple announcement shows, you know, this just happens. I've only been thinking about it for about a day, but I think it shows how we're being trained. You know, there's kind of a normalization process here that says, well, you know, you'll get used to having your facial features scanned to use your phone. As evidence that this is just becoming more normalized, churches are using facial recognition software to keep track of their parishioners, to actually see, okay, who's showing up, you know, each week for church.
Wow.
And so if that becomes acceptable and it's the price for opening up my iPhone, then I think we become conditioned to just, well, you know, maybe there's a creep in the back of my head, but I'm still going to do it. And then, you know, we're giving, you know, more information to advertisers than just the texts we type out or the notification that we're online and looking at a site. We're actually letting them see our facial expressions and maybe how we're reacting to particular advertisements, which is, you know, even better feedback for them.
What's so creepy about the churches? I was just reading a New York Times piece about social conservatives having a seat at the table under the Trump administration. I mean, what could the church do with that information? Maybe tell your boss that you didn't go to church last week, or your coach, your soccer coach, that you didn't go to church last week? I mean, what's being done with this information?
Yeah, I hadn't even thought of that. And of course, you know, it wasn't exactly a PR victory for the churches who were identified using this this facial recognition software. But at least at first blush, I think the thought was it's a way to keep track of attendance and perhaps see, you know, who's a regular attendee. You know, can we match that with maybe if they're, you know, tithing appropriately? But yeah, I think your suggestions are, you know, open up a whole world of possibilities.
Well, and in some cases even worse, let's say the DOJ or the police are doing an investigation about your family and they want to know where you were and when.
Yeah, right. And that brings up kind of a larger point about a lot of these commercial technologies for surveillance. You know, sometimes I talk to people about them and they say, well, you know, that's bad, but it's just advertising. Who cares? You know, it's just, right. just advertising. And I push back against that. But also, this information is then shared. It's not like there's a firm line between the information we give to commercial entities and the government. And so there have been examples where, you know, surveillance that's been recorded by Twitter, by Facebook, by Instagram is being disclosed either to the government directly in response to warrants and requests, or sometimes to third parties, and the third parties share this with law enforcement.
Talk about creepy. In your book, you write that Tesco, the world's second largest retailer, has screens in stores and at gas pumps that scan customers' faces so as to deliver individually targeted ads. Aware that the use of these data collection technologies may offend shopper sensibilities, businesses are now taking steps to mask their use. One strategy is to camouflage cameras so that consumers don't know they're being watched. Where is this happening, and how do we get this information?
Yeah, so Tesco, you know, is world's second largest retailer, and it's happening in Britain, which has somewhat different attitudes and approaches to privacy than in this country. But I wouldn't you know feel all that sanguine about it. You know, I think these technologies could be used here as well, and you know that is disturbing. You know, again, it goes to this idea of hiding things. So the hidden camera for me is much more disturbing than the camera in plain sight, even though I'm not thrilled with the camera in plain sight. And so when you're camouflaging these technologies to record how we behave, it's really hard to defend yourself against them, and mm-hmm. you really have no choice but to assume you're on camera all the time, and I think it injects a bit of fatalism into the equation. You're like, well, they just know everything about me, and I'm just going to have to give up.
Right. Today, we're speaking with Mark Bartholomew, professor at the University at Buffalo School of Law, about his new book, Ad Creep, The Case Against Modern Marketing. We have a number of callers on the line and a number of emails, Mark. So let's hear next from Jeremy in Mountain View. Hi, Jeremy. Welcome to the show. Do we have Jeremy? Let's try Carol in San Francisco. Hi, Carol.
Hi. The reason I'm calling is that recently I was vacationing in North Carolina, went into one of the major drugstore chains with my husband to buy mosquito repellent. After going, reading the labels and everything, we decided not to get the repellent. We bought something else. And as we checked out, they gave us coupons for repellent. And I'm wondering how they knew we had been looking at repellent.
So you didn't buy it at that store?
No.
Hmm. Yeah. Mark, what about that? I've been hearing a lot of people say that this happened to me. If you talk about something at home, when you go onto Facebook, you might see an ad for what you just talked about. What would you say in the case of Carol's experience in a store?
Yeah. And without knowing exactly how it happened, I just say it points to this whole process by where all the data is being pooled together. I think, you know, that for a long time we thought, well, if I interact with this business or interact with this website, sure, I'm giving data to this website, but they're not sharing it with everyone else. But it turns out that all this information is being bundled together. So I would hesitate to say, although who knows, that there was a hidden camera scrutinizing Carol while she looked at the mosquito repellents, although, you know, maybe that could possibly happen. But perhaps, you know, what would happen is that other purchases were correlated. Maybe what was purchased in that drugstore, maybe what was purchased at other times, maybe Carol's web history or something that tracked her location. And a lot of what's going on here is the power of big numbers. So to us, it might not be apparent that if you buy product A, B, and C, product D that you'll want is mosquito repellent. But when you crunch millions and millions of individual users' purchase histories, you know that, oh, if someone buys A, B, and C, 95% of the time they want D. And so I think that might have been what happened here. You know, a story about this that, you know, came out in the New York Times article a few years ago was the story about just certain purchase histories at Target confirmed for Target that someone was pregnant before they had disclosed at all to Target or anyone else that mm-hmm. they were pregnant. And so Target leveraged that information into steering them towards purchases for someone who was going to have a baby, right? Not because they disclosed that they were pregnant, but because just by buying lotion and these vitamins and maybe something else, Target knew they had a high, high percentage that that person was indeed pregnant.
Wow. Well, thank you for calling in, Carol. Let's go next to Harry in San Francisco. Hi, Harry. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good morning. I wondered if your guest had any examples of where it's been possible to curtail advertising sponsored by the municipal government here in San Francisco. When you go into BART, mm-hmm. you have to look down the floor and pillars are all covered with ads, and now they're planning on wrapping BART trays. The Muni light rail trains that are wrapped and the buses that are wrapped are really offensive, and it makes it more difficult to look out of them. Plus, they're just rolling ads. These tour buses that never used to exist have huge ads on them, and in general, there's the city policy of accepting this money for advertising no matter what. They're also on these garish and useless bus shelters. So I was wondering if your guest could tell us of any places where there's actually been a pushback against public advertising that's been successful and getting a municipal government to actually tone down the ads or remove them.
Thank you, Harry. Mark, you have a section in your book about infiltrating civic space.
Right. Harry, I love your question. So one thing is that it's not just that we're confronted with more advertising, but it's colonizing these spaces that were used to be ad-free or at least ad-resistant. So think national parks, think schools, and as Harry pointed out, these public spaces. And this is happening all over the country. I'm familiar with what's going on in San Francisco, and I used to live in San Francisco, but Chicago is even worse. Chicago has sold off spaces on trash cans and parking pay boxes on the pillars of a historic bridge, and other cities are doing this too. So that's the bad news. He asked for, well, can I point to anybody any city that has kind of pushed back against this? And so for a recent example, I can point to L.A. L.A. was thinking about auctioning off the naming rights to their light rail stops. And they had initially approved this plan, but they decided to go back on it and not go ahead with the deal. And I don't think it was because of any aesthetic concern about, well, we don't want advertising here. Why they decided not to go ahead with the naming rights deal was because they knew they would lose control. And that's something I talk about in the book. Once you allow advertisers into a space with, say, a naming rights deal, you lose under the First Amendment, at least the way the First Amendment is construed by the Supreme Court these days, the ability to do much picking and choosing between advertisers. And so what the municipal authorities in Los Angeles were concerned with is, well, once we allow this business to win naming rights, we can't exclude other businesses. And maybe some business will pony up the most money that will send a message that we don't think is appropriate or that would be somewhat unsavory. You know, think of Wells Fargo or Volkswagen clamoring to, you know, advertise on San Francisco City Hall just after those scandals broke. You know, you wouldn't want to be associated with that. And so for that reason, Los Angeles has pulled back. But I can tell you, New York City is thinking about auctioning off naming rights to their subway stations. Washington, D.C. Metro, which is in dire financial straits, is thinking about auctioning off naming rights. So the trend, unfortunately, I think, is in the other direction.
Wow. What can the public do about this?
Well, I think the first thing is just awareness. You know, I think that and until we think about this, we're not aware of the ads that are, you know, in our field of vision and they're entering these different spaces. That awareness, I think, is the key thing because public officials aren't going to change their attitudes. You know, they often see this as free money. They're not going to change their attitudes until they receive pushback from voters and their constituents. So first thing I'd say is just being aware. And then the second is, you know, making that displeasure with these kinds of trade-offs known to public officials. You know, there historians diagnosed three consumer movements in this country, and the last one really dates all the way back to the 60s and early 70s with Ralph Nader. And we haven't had a consumer movement, kind of a broad-based coalition of voters saying, we think this is important enough to attach to how we vote. We haven't really had that since the 70s, despite many advocacy groups pushing to restrain commercialism. And I think we just need to have that kind of critical mass before we're going to be able to change the attitudes of public officials to these kinds of deals.
You mentioned Chicago. This happened under Mayor Rahm Emanuel starting in 2012. You also write that in 2012, Florida Governor Rick Scott signed a bill allowing advertising on Florida's greenways and trails. New Hampshire has a state park sponsorship agreement in place with a sporting goods retailer. Maryland and Virginia have deals with North Face. As part of the deal, North Face can put its logo and scannable discount codes on trailhead signs. So you're supposed to get a discount before you go on a hike. And then California and New York have brokered similar bargains with companies like Nestle, Coca-Cola, and Odwalla. And although the National Park Service bans most advertising, in 2015, it reversed a longstanding policy barring the display of corporate donors' logos. In national forests, companies can now put up ads along roads and trails, inside concession buildings, and in other areas.
Right, and the question is, well, why is this disturbing? You know, what's the problem with that? And at least for me, it goes down to, well, why were these particular places created in the first place? And so the national parks were created in part because of a desire to close off certain beautiful spaces from commercialism, not just from development and industrialism, to protect the animals and the natural settings, but specifically because they didn't want commercial signage and advertising in there. So I live close to Niagara Falls, and Niagara Falls was kind of example number one in the 19th century of what not to do. There was written this kind of garish advertisement for a product called St. John's Oil on this rock that was right next to the falls, and Europeans would come and visit and kind of laugh about how Americans had ruined their natural wonders. And so that prompted a national parks movement to say, you know what, we're going to create these spaces and we're going to quarantine them from commercial forces. And those examples you just gave from the book show us backsliding, us moving in the other direction. And I think that's that changes the character of those spaces, and it shrinks the number of spaces we have that don't articulate a certain message, kind of a materialist message, a message about the individual and not the community. That's lost when we allow advertising into these spaces.
We're going to get back to calls in just a minute, but I just want to also point out that in your book, you write that more than 80% of American public school students witness some form of overt non-school related advertising every single school day. And again, you have a number of examples, just a couple, very egregious example. An elementary school in Polk County, Florida, accepted a $300 donation from the Rogers and Walker Gun Shop. In return, the gun shop's name was placed on the school's marquee. 70% of elementary and middle school students are exposed to in-school food marketing. Some see ads for Pizza Huts and McDonald's on their report cards. Mark, I gotta say, I thought this was The Onion when I read that sentence. They really see ads for McDonald's on their report cards?
Right, that has happened. Yeah, schools have inked these deals, right? So, I think that this is another example of a territory where, and I'm not going to pretend that our public schools were always completely commercial free, and you can look back and see other instances and decades ago where advertisers, in some way had their presence felt in the schools. But those statistics about, 78% of students are exposed to these marketing messages on an average school day really show how it's open season. And again, this changes the character of an environment, perhaps without us realizing it. That, what John Dewey, the most famous American theorist on public education, he said, well, the public schools are designed to, of course, teach reading, writing, and arithmetic, but they're also designed to teach us how to behave in a democracy. They're designed to teach us civic communal values. And I think that's lost when, the student is exposed to these marketing messages as they go through the school each day. It tends to dilute the alternative messages that are being sent by the school. And, as we confront today, more and more discussion about how people aren't able to talk to each other, how they kind of live in these informational silos, I think, allowing these commercial intrusions in what was supposed to be a civic communal space, it's not going to help that problem.
Right. And this is directly connected to tax cuts, because as budgets are cut on a regular basis, a lot of people say we have no choice. We need the money for the schools. We need the money for the public parks. But that's for a different conversation, but it is very connected to all of this. We have just a couple minutes left, and Robert wants to know how this compares with other countries. Are we subjected to advertising more than other citizens around the world? And can you please be specific?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. And, you know, I don't have the data on, you know, how many ads you see per day in Denmark versus how many ads per day you see in the United States. I'd say this is a worldwide trend, but there are some things about the American story that are a little bit different. And one of them is the First Amendment. And normally we think of the First Amendment as doing all these great things, but the way the First Amendment has been construed by the courts in recent years, this is a relatively recent phenomenon, as they've said, you know, we're gonna be very hands off when it comes to regulating what private businesses do as far as advertising, but we'll be very, very skeptical of any government's attempt to restrict advertising or to promote government kind of counter advertising. You know, think of campaigns against smoking, right? And so the courts have time and time again said that, well, there's a big protection against restrictions on commercial speech, and that's a different approach than in other countries. In Europe, for example, there is much more of a willingness for the government to intervene and say, you know, we're going to set limits on product placement in movies or TV shows, particularly those that are aimed at kids. We're going to set restrictions on how much corporate surveillance is possible and how long that data can be collected by businesses without showing it to consumers. So there are differences between this country and other countries, and I think for the most part, they're not favorable differences if you're concerned about this problem.
Here in the United States, the very corporations that you write about in your book give money to politicians, and you write that the response of legislators and regulators to advertising's colonization of public space has been muted at best. Can you talk in the final minutes we have about what could be done legally about this and what you think the average citizen can do about this?
Yeah, so, you know, I'm a law professor, so I naturally gravitate towards legal solutions, and I won't get too wonky here, but I think that there are things we can do to change the law so that consumers have more protections. So one thing we could do is we could interpret contract law in a different way so that this constant sea of kind of clicks on boilerplate to forfeit our rights to our data that can be leveraged against us later for market research, we could change how we interpret contract law to say, no, there has to be more notice, more disclosure. It can't be in that small font you mentioned earlier. It has to be very, very transparent and not in legalese. I think that could help the situation. We could require more government oversight of these kinds of applied market research, the neuromarketing we talked earlier. We might say, well, we're going to embed federal regulators at some of these big advertising houses or these big companies, and they need to be clued in on these problems before they happen. We need to have some government oversight. We already think this is important enough to do with banks and Wall Street firms, where we have regulators on the ground in those facilities, you know, kind of looking over their shoulder. Maybe we need to do something like that. You know, another thing is, you know, maybe we need to set some limits on private platforms like Facebook, like Twitter, and say, you know, there'll be restrictions on what you can do, or there'll be requirements that you have to be more transparent. You know, this news recently about these political ads paid for by these kind of shadowy server farms linked to Russia, you know, require Facebook to be more transparent. When we're talking about television networks, there's all sorts of electoral requirements that require this sort of disclosure of who paid for it, what went on, what audience did it reach. Facebook isn't required to play by those rules, and maybe they should have to be. And you also asked about what can us as consumers do. I think it goes again to just being aware and mobilizing. Until there's kind of a movement in this country to say this is enough of a social problem that we think there should be changes, nothing will change.
Mark Bartholomew is professor at the University of Buffalo School of Law and author of the book Ad Creep, The Case Against Modern Marketing. Mark, thanks so much for your reporting on this, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks. I had a great time.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.